Good morning. This is Lisa Schroff, and I want to thank you for joining me on this Tuesday, August 18th of 2026. Before I begin my comments, I want to remind you that if any recommendations that I make on this call can be accessed by contacting Lisa Schroff and Company. Okay, first of all, we have a few earnings releases to go over, but I want to start with kind of a big picture of some of the things happening out there in the last few weeks. One item of notable interest is that long-term interest rates popped up yesterday, I believe it was, to a 19-year high on the 30-year U.S. Treasury to 5.3%, which is close to where it is today. And so if you take a look at the yield curve, you'll see that it's steepened, meaning that long-term rates are higher and short-term rates are lower than where they were a year ago. In fact, as I look at the yield curve from now versus, let's say, a month ago and even a year ago, the long bond all the way down to the 10-year, they're all higher. 10-year and longer are all higher than they were a week ago, a month ago, and a year ago. And then when you get down to less than a year ago, short-term rates were higher than they are today, quite a bit higher, actually. And so the yield curve is what they call has steepened, and the long rates are higher. And often analysts say that the Fed can control short rates by setting the overnight lending rates, the Federal Reserve Board, but they have a harder time controlling long rates because that is more of a market reaction to a number of things. And in this case, it's probably higher rates are a reaction to ongoing higher oil prices than, let's say, a year ago. Geopolitical tensions, which on any given day are higher or lower. I think they're higher today. Fiscal concerns, which are rising, and especially rising over the last year. Well, they've been rising for years, but certainly fiscal concerns over the federal debt issuance, the budget deficit, and the rising debt on the U.S. Treasury balance sheet, and then also related to that, weighing on bond prices is just the ongoing supply pressure. And that is, if we're operating at a deficit and we have a big debt load, we need to sell bonds. And so, we've been doing a lot of bond sales. I think it's mostly at the short end, because that's where the rates are really low. But nevertheless, the rest of the world is watching this. And while we are probably, as they say, one of the better the better situated of a bad situation around the world, nevertheless, the U.S. as a reserve currency, our role has been to have a pretty strong balance sheet to deserve the reserve currency of the world position. And increasingly, investors are starting to look at our budget deficit and our rising debt saying, well, I'm not so sure, maybe we better hedge our bets. And a lot of countries are doing that. You're seeing countries sell U.S. Treasuries for a number of reasons, other reasons too. They need to buy oil or other reasons. But nevertheless, you're seeing some historical buyers of U.S. Treasuries buy less and or sell. And so it's really raised the antenna of the investors around the world, and that is probably part of the reason why the 30-year treasury rates are at their highest in 19 years. What has happened in the last 2 weeks especially is a backup in the price of silver and gold somewhat. And this is a phenomenon that kind of started a month ago, but it became really noticeable about 2 weeks ago. And I mentioned that because comes at a time when the CPI came out a little bit lesser than expected, but yet the 30-year yield on the U.S. Treasury rate is higher than it was 2 weeks ago or even a month ago. And I think that some of this has to do with world effects, and that is we're seeing as the numbers come out, and they can be fudged, but other central banks in the world have been buying gold as maybe a hedge as an alternative to U.S. Treasuries. And we don't see Western buyers buying gold much. We see Eastern world buyers buying gold, and we see central banks buying gold. But basically, the broad investor market has yet to play into an interest in buying precious metals. It's really the interest has been primarily with the central banks. But we see it in their minds as hedging their U.S. dollar reserves. Okay, well, that's bullish, by the way. That's bullish for gold and silver. These stocks have had pretty good bounces in the last couple of weeks. It's nice to see. And I'm going to get on before I talk about some other bigger picture stories. I want to talk just a little bit about precious metals because these companies have been reporting their second quarter earnings. And while in general their second quarter earnings were probably not as good as the first quarter because the price of gold on average was and silver was down from the first quarter of 2026 to the second quarter, so their realized prices were lower, nevertheless, they were blockbuster numbers on most counts. And I'll talk first of all about Hecla Mining, which is a silver mining company we own. They had a very strong quarter. They have their strongest balance sheet in history. Certainly they had lower gold prices in the second quarter versus the first quarter, but far higher versus a year ago. And just to give you an idea of how the quarter went, their net income was $118 million versus $27 million a year ago, but down from the first quarter at $164 million. Their earnings per share were 18 cents versus 4 cents a year ago, down again from the first quarter at 25 cents in the first quarter. Their free cash flow for Hecla Mining was $136 million, free cash flow. And for those of you that aren't quite sure what free cash flow means, it means all cash coming into the company minus all cash going out of the company in the quarter. Free cash flow was $136 million versus $66 million a year ago, and certainly down again from the first quarter of $143 million, but a huge, more than doubling, or about doubling, versus a year ago. So as you can imagine, Hecla's balance sheet is the strongest in history. They now have no net debt. They have cash on the balance sheet of $587 million. And their free cash flow is just tremendous. And it occurred to me, and I'm kind of joking here, but maybe not really. You've probably been reading about how all the, or not all, but many of the, what we call technology hyperscalers, those companies that are having to build out data centers, such as Microsoft, such as Amazon, such as Google. These companies are having, and Meta, they're all having to build out these data centers to be able to support artificial intelligence. And they're spending billions and billions of dollars. Their free cash flows used to be very positive. These were the big growth stocks, and they've gone very negative now. They've gone negative, I'll just say. I mean, it's just been a huge 180-degree change in their cash flow prospects because of this required capital spending that they're all doing. And so as a result, they're actually selling debt. They're actually selling stock, which was never the case before, except for when maybe they had their original public offerings. But now they're needing to raise cash. And I'm kind of joking here, but not really. But maybe these technology hyperscalers should consider buying the precious metals companies and use the precious metals companies' free cash flows to build out their data centers. Who would have guessed that the story across the board in the precious metals companies, that is gold and silver mining companies, is one of blockbuster cash flows? Another company that reported, Pan American Silver, that is a silver and now also a gold company. They reported a good quarter, but it was lighter than analysts expected. They reported 73 cents versus 43 cents a year ago, a great quarter, but analysts had been expecting the company to earn something like 84 cents a share. So the stock actually did go down that day. They did say that the reason for the lower than expected earnings was because they had a big bump up in the second quarter taxes, which will even itself out in the rest of the year. And they also had lighter production at one of their gold mine, Jacobina, because they had to do some seismic work that's considered precautionary. But I think analysts didn't really like that. Nevertheless, the cash flows, again, were big, big free cash flow. The other thing, too, is everyone has been hoping that this company will someday be able to reopen their Escobal silver mine in Guatemala, which they bought as part of the Tahoe mining acquisition a few years ago. It was closed then. It's still closed. The company said that they have no opening date, and I think analysts were maybe a little disappointed on no progress there as well. But they are continuing to talk to the government of Guatemala about reopening it. Newmont Mining also had some news. They were actually earlier, I think we talked about that 2 weeks ago, but the stock actually had a big surge in price one day, about 10 days ago. And the reason being that Barrick Company, which is a gold mining company based in, a large gold mining company based in Canada, announced that they had finally settled with Newmont Mining on the valuation of the 4 Mile mine based in Nevada, which Newmont partly owns along with Barrick. And Newmont, to be able to own it, I guess fully, I'm not sure about that, will have to pay Barrick, which is fine, but they're paying Barrick a whole lot less than analysts thought they'd have to pay to get it. They're paying Barrick about $2 billion, one analyst had thought they'd have to pay more than twice that to give them a cash payment for the part that Barrick owned. And so analysts were looking at that saying, wow, you got a great asset for a steal of a deal. And that's why the stock surged that day. It has to do with a transaction that came at what appears to be a favorable price to Newmont Mining. Okay, so that's all the good news. I want to talk a little bit about, to get back to the big picture, just a couple of things out there. First of all, I talked about this a couple of weeks ago, and I'll probably talk about it more in the future. But a lot of the companies have been reporting. We've got our own companies to report, but it just is amazing to me how what a high percentage of earnings, and it created a huge bulge in earnings among some of these tech companies that own companies that are going public in artificial intelligence or have had valuation rounds of, you know, investments that are at higher levels. And just to give you an example, Amazon reported their second quarter, and Amazon owns part of Anthropic, which is planning to go public, and they are planning to go public at possibly close to the valuation that SpaceX went public at, which was at $1.8 trillion in value when SpaceX went public at $135 per share. Anthropic announced it hopes to go public within the next couple of months. And they want a big valuation as well. And what they're riding on is their revenues have grown dramatically. I mean, absolutely dramatically. This is artificial intelligence. But Amazon was able to mark up its ownership. It owns a piece of Anthropic in the second quarter. And roughly half of the earnings that Amazon reported was due to the markup alone of Anthropic. Likewise, Google, when they reported their second quarter, they had a whopping earnings release of $112 billion. I think I read that right. But 99 billion of that was the unrealized gains on equity holdings of mostly SpaceX, which did go public during that period. So in other words, I do have this correct. 88% of Google's reported earnings in the second quarter were due to a markup in valuation. And that's legal. There's nothing wrong with that because Berkshire Hathaway does it every quarter because they own a lot of pieces of a lot of companies. But just so you know, if it ever turns around and the valuations go down, you also have to mark your ownership down as well. And so that is something that's not always all good news, but it's just mind-boggling to see these markups. They're just huge. Also wanted to mention piece of information, and I find this interesting. As you know, I've always been very good about talking about the glasses half empty instead of half full. In other words, you know, numbers are good. During periods of time when we outperform the market, I sometimes would rather talk about what's not working. I will do that again, but I wanted to mention, and it just is amazing to me, speaking of technology, as you know, we owned Intel as a turnaround, and the stock went down a lot, and we patiently waited for it to rebound, and our theory was that the company could recover. This is a semiconductor company, and it did rebound, and we eventually sold the stock several months ago. But what happened after that, as you know, is the semiconductor stocks have had a big run, and we do not own it. We did not own it for that big run. And as I look at Intel, yes, the stock is down, you know, about 40% from where it did trade, but it's still up significantly from where we sold it. But what I do want to point out is, and it's just amazing to me, that about a week ago, or about 2 weeks ago, they announced that they were going to do a stock offering, and they were going to raise, and they did, $15 billion, $15 billion. And it is amazing to me to know that when we owned Intel at the depths of their problems, because that's what we do, we buy turnarounds sometimes, and we buy them out of favor, it is gut-wrenching, but we wait for their prospects to change, and they often do, such that it creates some appreciation in the stock. Well, their fortunes eventually did change, but when we owned the stock at the depths of their problems, to even think they could possibly do a stock offering at the valuations that they did and raise $15 billion is just unfathomable. But that is how the market's love of technology has changed from being very out of favor to in favor. And we think that that will probably change again, as it has been with some of these stocks actually significantly, some of these stocks significantly off their very high levels, because there have been in recent, I would say, weeks, concern over the amount of money that's being spent on infrastructure required for artificial intelligence. The last thing I wanted to mention is just a piece of news that I saw, and someone pointed this out to me, and I just can't help but mention it. And I will talk from a very high level because I don't know the guy's business well, but his name is Mark Walters. And it was announced, I think, just in the last few days that he is a majority owner of the Los Angeles Lakers, among a number of other sports teams. And he just sold or is in the process of selling his share, majority ownership in the Los Angeles Lakers, to Josh Kushner and Bob Iger, who is the retired past CEO of Disney, for a whopping $12.5 billion. And just so you know, about a year and a half ago, Mark Walters actually made his purchase at, I think, a $10 billion valuation. So in other words, the headlines read, Mark Walters makes $2.5 billion on an almost short-term holding of a professional sports team. But what you should know, and this was underneath the headline, the reason that he quickly found a buyer is because he's having a cash crunch. And related to that, there's a federal investigation between 16 and $21 billion in related party loans and private credit transactions. Mark Walters owns a company called Delaware Life Insurance, and some of these loans apparently are tied to his life insurance company. And why would I even bother mentioning this? Because it wasn't the headlines, it was really just the fine print that is of interest to me, and that is, I've been talking about this, private credit, real estate, private equity, all of these businesses, which I call illiquid, can make people a lot of money, and during good times you can leverage them up at low interest rates and then get, you know, multiple returns on your original investment. But during the down cycle or a period when interest rates are rising, it is tougher to make money. And not only that, sometimes there are what we call markdowns on the valuations of these loans, on the valuations of the commercial office properties, on the valuations of the private companies. And that is exactly what's starting to happen. And I'm sure we're going to read more about this, but I consider it, quote, the beginning of the unraveling of some of these really spectacular past returns. And this headline about the sale of the Los Angeles Lakers is really, to me, might be really kind of the announcement that really gets investors looking at this whole illiquid asset business and the downside of it. Okay, I want to talk a little bit about a few other companies that we own in the portfolio. I think a real highlight was Grupo Cybest, also known as Bank Colombia. Not certainly as exciting as technology, but the company had a blockbuster quarter. This has been a really great stock to own in the Lisa Schroff and Company's portfolios. The company earned in the second quarter, $3.32 a share. And it wasn't that long ago, it was, I want to say, this stock only about 3 years ago was a $24 stock, and their quarterly earnings were $3.32. And the estimates were far lower than that, and they just had lower loan losses. The Colombian economy is growing, and it's possible, and I don't know if this has something to do with the strength in the stock, but the stock, as you know, has been probably one of the stronger bank stocks maybe in the world of what I consider to be a real major bank. And I think part of it possibly has to do with the politics in Colombia. A pro-business person was elected as the new president, which is, you know, always seen positively on a country's business environment, especially Colombia, which has in the past had issues with its politics and its economy. Okay, also wanted to mention International Seaways, another company that reported blockbuster earnings. This is a company that ships fuel both in raw oil and byproducts. International Seaways reported in the second quarter $5.91 a share in earnings versus $1.02 a year ago. In other words, roughly earnings were five and a half times what they were a year ago. Free cash flow was $261 million versus $71 million. That is versus a year ago. That is an important number because that's all cash coming into the company minus all cash going out in the quarter. These are huge numbers. The company announced a dividend of $5.05 a share. This is not an annual dividend, by the way, but their policy has been to report to pay out 85% of their earnings in dividends. So if they earn $5.91 in the quarter per share, they're paying out $5.05 in dividends. And just to give you a notion of that, Over the past 12 months, International Seaways has paid out, including this dividend, $12.61 a share in dividends. Keep in mind, in 2022, I don't recall what price we exactly bought it at, but in 2022, when we started buying it, or in that year, the stock was only a $15 stock. And they paid out $12.61 in dividends over the past 12 months, including the dividend just announced. I mean, this is just mind-boggling. Again, I look at some of these companies, the cash flow that they're experiencing, both in precious metals and some of the other commodities, and certainly some of these stocks have done very, very well, but I still think a lot of investors don't even get it. Okay, International Seaways, obviously their business is benefiting from, unfortunately, the Iran conflict and the Ukraine war. This company, for many reasons, still has a bullish outlook. We continue to hold International Seaways. Also, just briefly, I want to mention Fluor Corporation and Tudor Perini. Those companies, they're construction companies. They both reported great earnings for their second quarters. These are what I call infrastructure plays. And maybe in a weird way, it is our way to invest in artificial intelligence. And you scratch your head and you go, why? What does that have to do with it? Well, they build data centers. That's not their biggest business. In fact, it's a small business. In the case of Fluor, they build electric power plants and energy plants. That's what they're most known for. But yeah, a data center here and there. Tudor Perini builds bridges. They build light rail. But they build data centers. But both of these companies are reporting exploding new awards on the upside for projects. They're reporting exploding backlog on the upside for their backlogs and really strong earnings and cash flow and strengthening of their balance sheets. And so what's the story here? It's just infrastructure in general. The United States, and Fluor has an international business, but the United States in particular is way behind on infrastructure. I've been saying that for years, and the catch-up is happening. That benefits Tudor Perini. In the case of Fluor, they are one of the single most builders of electric power plants, including nuclear, as well as energy infrastructure. One of their biggest customers is, as an example, Aramco. So I won't get into the detail on those two companies, but those stocks have benefited from recent earnings and really positive outlooks. And okay, last I'll just mention Hawaiian Electric reported. It's work in process. They reported pretty good results. This company, when we bought Hawaiian Electric, it's an electric utility based in Hawaii. We bought it right after the Maui wildfires, believing that the Hawaiian regulatory commissions in the state would help this company recover, and they have. And I think it's going to take a while to work out. But the company did report there were no really big surprises there, except that this is an interesting development. There's a company out of Japan that wants to build a natural gas-fired plant to replace all of Hawaiian Electric's oil. Hawaiian Electric is one of the last remaining utilities in the United States that uses a lot of oil because they have no natural resources. They have wind and they have some solar, but they do need base load that is not intermittent. And so a company out of Japan has proposed to build a natural gas fire plant of where they would import natural gas. Very interesting development. We'll be watching that. Okay, with that, I'm going to go ahead and end my comments, and I'm going to go ahead and open it up for questions if there are any. Okay, are there any questions?
Lisa, on Nutrien, can you talk about their business? I know it's kind of cyclical, and do you have a price target by any chance?
Yes. In the case of Nutrien, they are a fertilizer manufacturer, as you know. And this company has had their ups and downs. I will just tell you they've had their ups and downs in that they got into a business in Brazil. They thought they'd start retail that is selling to the farmers, not just wholesale. And what's happened is it didn't work out very well. So I would just tell you that in the case of Nutrien, one of the benefits has been that the price of fertilizer is up, and they have great access to potash, which is definitely their biggest component, as well as other natural resources. Because they're based in Canada, they have a very good resource for that. And one of the things that's helped certainly is the lack of ability to get fertilizer. The Ukraine area, Belarus, Russia, a friend of Russia, has had limitations to what it is allowed to export because of the trade sanctions. And so companies like Nutrien that are what I call outside of that whole area have really benefited. And so this company has never really, it's had a rebound. I mean, back in 2022 when the Ukraine war started, the stock had a really big bounce. Then it came down, and now it's recovered maybe half of those declines. But I do think the stock could, over time, recover better. And so I would say that where it trades here, a reasonable price for the stock could be somewhere, I would say, U.S. dollars around 90 eventually, and I think that's very possible. It has not been one of our better stocks. It's purely a farm play, but one of the things that's hurt Nutrien is some of their past missteps, such as their Brazilian retail operations. They just have to get past that. And as you know, if you look at the Lisa Schroffen company portfolios, we like agriculture. We like agriculture. We like commodities. This is a whole area that kind of frankly hasn't really gotten any respect for a long time. And we think we're in the beginnings or maybe the second or third inning of what I consider to be a commodity cycle. Any other questions? Okay, if there aren't any more questions, I'm going to go ahead and end the call. I want to thank you for joining me this morning, and I'll be back in 2 weeks.